Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Down the Tube, Really Random Stuff with Miss Darkholm, brought to you by a team of voices, a group located on allpoetry.com, the largest poetry site in the world. And as always, we'd like to say thank you to Kevin and his crew for giving us the space to share our poetry, and of course to Deborah Lee and the A.P. Taylor Poetry Foundation for supporting the group, running the group, and supporting the blog talk so we can share poetry live. I am your host, Sky, and tonight, as always, once a month, we travel down the tube and talk about some really random stuff. Tonight's topic is giants, of course. We have three topics that I will get into later this evening. A little bit about our opening music. It is by an artist called Ezra Vine. He is a multi-instrumentalist, obsessed with escapism, indulging in his melodic fantasies among hand claps and the waltz of bass drums. A little bit about him: recorded in a small bedroom in late 2012, armed only with one microphone, a Mac Pro, and any instrument he can lay his hands on. Vine meticulously recorded each and every instrument, breathing life into a handful of tunes that would soon become unofficially dubbed in the Les Infants EP. The resulting work was a collision of immediate lyricism, haunting falsetto, and counter melodies woven through folk sensibilities. After hitting the New Zealand charts in 2013 with his hit single, Celeste, which we just listened to, Ezra Vine gained worldwide attention from various recorded labels, publishing companies, and brands, eventually singing in a worldwide deal with Parlophone Records. Now a full band, Ezra Vine recently toured the UK, including playing standing room only shows at the Great Escape Festival in Brighton. So I hope you enjoyed that opening. I will give a disclaimer. I am getting over a cold, so if my voice seems a little funny to you today, I did not want to cancel, but I am still recovering. So if I press pause and random spots, it might be to cough, and I might break up a little bit when I'm speaking. So I hope you guys don't mind that. We're going to have some fun. I already have someone on the line to say hello to. Hello, Rack. How are you?
Okay. Do I sound funny to you?
Do I sound funny to you? I know I sound funny. I sound a lot better than I have sounded the past couple days. So I'm getting there. My voice is just a little, it's not quite there yet. So, but no, you don't sound funny.
No.
You don't sound funny, I guess. You're a funny guy. So, I mean, there's that. So I am, how was your week? How's it going?
Well, it's only, what, Tuesday? But, you know, it's all right, I guess. I don't know. As a lot of monotony and stuff.
Well, it's only Tuesday, but for me, I'm counting down the every day of this week. It's the last week of school. Summer vacation is on its way. I mean, I'll still be working, but not at the school. But so we've got this final countdown going. We're like 3 more days till we have to enter the building. sounds like I hate my job. All right, so I have 3 clips that I brought to share what we're going to be talking about, and of course, we usually go a little off topic. They're all brought to you by PBS, so I hope you enjoy PBS because that's what we're going to be playing.
Yeah. the public broadcast
system. You know, I really love. I watch a lot of, I mean, there's a couple that I really enjoy. The YouTube, obviously, I bring them here, the YouTube little documentaries that they have at PBS. And there's a couple that I go to a lot. There's like the What If people. Yeah, there's like a What If channel, and it's like, what if this happened? What if this happened? And then it says how it would affect our world today, and then, of course, goes into what really happened and the science behind it.
That's awesome.
And then there's another guy. I mean, I brought a lot of them here, so, but there's just a few of them that are funny, quirky. what is that? Planet? What is that one? With the planet. I can't think of the name now, but I tend to stick with the same ones that I know are good.
Right.
But every once in a while I find new ones, but yeah. Well, I'm gonna kick it off with, I think, let me see what Deb wrote about, and I won't do that one because she usually does a lot of homework. And I don't want to take that from her. Okay, so she did the frogs. Holy moly. I'm not reading it, Deb. I'm just looking at the pictures. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we're going to go with the sea scorpions. So we're going to listen to a little video about that, and then Rack, you and I can chat, and we'll go from there. Oh, and if we go with the sea scorpions, we can play your poem because it's about the sea. All right, here we go.
We'd like to thank Audible for supporting PBS. Some 400 million years ago in the early Devonian period, the world was a very different place. Sea levels were high, and the continents were surrounded by vast, shallow seas full of exotic creatures like rugose corals, crinoids, and jawless fish. And in what's now Utah, one such fish met an end that was as grim as it was typical. The jawless fish known as Lecriaspis was killed by three distinct puncture wounds to the head, puncture wounds made by crushing claws. The culprit was an apex predator that dominated the seas of the late Silurian and early Devonian, the sea scorpion. Sea scorpions thrived for 200 million years, and they came in a wide variety of shapes and sizes, from Alcanopterus, which was about the size of a paperclip, to the terrifying Ye Calopterus, which was 2.5 meters long. But in time, these able hunters would meet some stiff competition. In the late Devonian, giant armor-jawed fish, the placoderms, would come to dominate these seas and force other ocean dwellers to adapt, flee, or perish. These formidable predators would give the period its nickname, the Age of Fish. And as a result of this competition, sea scorpions would eventually diverge into two distinct lineages, each with its own unique strategy for dealing with the rise of fish. They developed a number of adaptations, from those crushing claws that snag the unlucky Lecriaspis, to the flattened tails for swimming, as well as primitive lungs and strange filter-feeding appendages. And some of them adapted by getting so big that they still hold the record for the largest arthropods of all time. They would even make the giant historic leap from the water onto dry land, but unlike their other arthropod relatives that we share the world with today, for the sea scorpions, that move would prove to be the beginning of the end. Scientists know sea scorpions by their proper, more accurate, but also somewhat less cool name, Eurypterids. And Eurypterids probably aren't ancestral to the arachnids we know as scorpions today. Sea scorpions and true scorpions are actually sister clades that both belong to a subphylum known as Chelicerata, an ancient group of arthropods that first appeared in the oceans of the Cambrian period. By the time the Silurian period rolled around, tens of millions of years later, the two clades had diverged, each adapting a different way of breathing that ultimately set them down very different evolutionary paths. In the lineage of true scorpions, external respiration organs called book gills were adapted into internal book lungs. These lungs allowed the ancestors of today's arachnids to become some of the first animals ever to colonize land. Sea scorpions, meanwhile, retained their book gills, which are similar to what horseshoe crabs use to breathe today, and this kept them dependent on water, mostly. But they also developed a second respiratory system, known as a chymoplankton, which functioned as a rudimentary lung and allowed them to take short trips onto land. Because of these features, some researchers believe that chymoplankton allowed sea scorpions to mate and lay their eggs on land, or even develop an amphibious lifestyle. But as history would show, this adaptation would prove to be a limitation as well as an advantage. In 2015, the earliest known Eurypterid, Pentacopterus declorahensis, was discovered in rocks in Iowa that date back 467 million years. It had compound eyes, a two-section body, and six pairs of appendages. The first pair, by the mouth, would have been used for feeding, while the other five were used for moving around. Sea scorpions would soon come to be defined by how these appendages adapted, splitting off into two distinct suborders with two very different evolutionary strategies. The first suborder to appear was Stylonuria, and its first known member, Brachiopterus, showed up just 9 million years after Pentacopterus in what's now Wales. This species was a humble little water monster just under 20 centimeters long, and it scuttled along on 10 legs scavenging for food at the bottom of the shallow seas. Like all of the Stylonurians that would follow, Brachiopterus used its appendages for walking and stuck to a strategy of scavenging and filter feeding on the seafloor in order to stay out of the way of fish, which were on the rise. But during the late Ordovician, a second suborder of sea scorpion emerges in the fossil record, the Eurypterina. The earliest known Eurypterine is a little species dated to 445 million years ago, discovered in the shales of South Africa. And these sea scorpions had a pair of appendages that were more like paddles, which allowed them to swim, a lifestyle that put them in direct competition with jawless fish and cephalopods. The newfound mobility of this group allowed it to diversify throughout the Silurian, and fast, as they were able to colonize new areas and take advantage of new niches. Plus, by competing with fish and cephalopods, they put themselves under selective pressure and launched an evolutionary arms race with other swimmers. This led to much greater diversity in this suborder, which is probably why 75% of all known Eurypterid species and more than 95% of all specimens ever found belong to Eurypterina. But as the Silurian gave way to the Devonian, a dangerous new competitive pressure entered the seas, the armored jawed fish known as the placoderms. So after reaching their peak diversity at the very start of the Devonian period, the number of Eurypterine species begins to drop in the fossil record, likely because many simply couldn't compete with this newer powerhouse predator. But the Eurypterines that did survive managed to stage a sort of evolutionary rally, getting bigger, faster, and stronger in the Devonian to cope with seas filled with placoderms that were doing the same. So we probably have placoderms to thank for the nightmare fuel that followed, a family of giant Eurypterines that persisted for nearly 40 million years. These are known as the pterygotids. They were some of the only sea scorpions to cross the open ocean, exploring the seas between the continents of Euramerica and Gondwana. And several aspects of their anatomy indicate that they were active, powerful predators. They had thin, lightweight exoskeletons that helped them move faster, and flattened tails called telsons that gave them extra swimming power. Their eyes faced forward and had thousands of lenses, giving them keen eyesight for spotting prey. And they caught that prey with mouth appendages called chelicera that ended in large raptor-like claws. These claws were so robust that they often preserve better than the thin exoskeleton, and sometimes they're the only parts that remain in the fossils of pterygotids. Many pterygotids reached over 1 meter in length, but the king of them all was Y. calopterus, the largest arthropod that has ever lived, maxing out at 2.5 meters long. It was described from a claw found in Germany in 2007 that's nearly a half meter long, with tooth-like serrations that were about the size of a tiger's canine teeth. But despite their best efforts, these invertebrates couldn't keep up with the placoderms, and Eurypterines lost over 50% of their diversity within the first 10 million years of the Devonian. By the end of the Devonian, all of the giant marine Eurypterines had gone extinct. Only one swimming genus, the tiny and widely dispersed Adelphothalmus, remained. But while the dramatic rise and fall of the Eurypterina had been happening out at sea, the slow and steady Stylonuria were still hanging on. In contrast to their cousins, the Eurypterines, the Stylonurians remained relatively unaffected by the rise of fish. While the Eurypterines were busy competing with fish, Stylonurians moved inland to brackish and freshwater ecosystems where there were fewer placoderms and less competition. By the time of the Carboniferous period, about 360 million years ago, Gondwana and Euramerica had come together, allowing the Stylonurians to spread out over the new supercontinent. Now, the Carboniferous is most famous for giant arthropods like the 2-meter-long millipedes and the griffin flies with wingspans larger than that of some birds. But if you were to hang around the muddy banks of a river, you might just spot the last of the giant sea scorpions, a big weirdo called Hibbertopterus. This was a very different sort of creature from the swimming predators that had come before. It was basically a big tank-like Roomba, slowly combing the sediment at the bottoms and the banks of swamps and rivers with spiny, sweep-feeding appendages. A big trackway discovered in Carboniferous rock in Scotland has been attributed to Hibbertopterus. And these tracks suggest that while it wasn't as long as Y. calopterus, it was probably heavier, with thicker legs to support it on land. Scientists don't really know why Hibbertopterus got so big, but the size increase was gradual, indicating that it might have been to better adapt to the species' new freshwater home. That's because chelicerates have blood that has a salinity similar to that of seawater, so a larger body size and thicker exoskeleton would have helped insulate Hibbertopterus to maintain its blood salinity in fresh water and even in the open air. Hibbertopterus died out in the Carboniferous, but other Hibbertopterids persisted for millions of years. The final Eurypterid, Campylocephalus permianus, disappeared at the end of the Permian period during the biggest extinction event in Earth's history. The end Permian extinction event, also called the Great Dying, was probably triggered by massive volcanic eruptions in Siberia that warmed the climate and killed off more than 96% of marine species and 70% of species on land. Campylocephalus was among the many casualties, and with its demise, the 210 million year age of Eurypterids was brought to an end. While sea scorpions ultimately succumbed to the evolutionary pressures of powerful new vertebrates and mass extinction events, for a big window of time, they were the most fearsome and diverse arthropods around. And they show us how different evolutionary paths can have very different outcomes. By laying low and avoiding competition, Stylonurians stuck around millions of years longer, while Eurypterines were far more diverse and plentiful at their peak. In the end, their undoing might have been their inability to fully colonize the next frontier, dry land, where there was less competition and many more niches to fill. While the sea scorpions couldn't make the transition, it was made successfully by the Eurypterid sister group, the arachnids. Maybe if they developed a way to leave the water sooner, sea scorpions would still be around. Today, just three classes of Calicerata remain. On land, there are the arachnids like spiders, ticks, and true scorpions. And in the seas, there are the sea spiders and the primordial-looking horseshoe crabs, living reminders of the watery origin of the Calicerates and the reign of the sea scorpions.
Excellent. So, what do you think? Arachnosaur, 8 feet. 8 feet.
Oh man! You know, it's funny. The thing that comes to mind for me, you know, I'm a guy, and you know, I my childhood was always, you know. Sorry. It's uncontrollable over here.
Are you all right?
I don't know if you hear the stupid thing screaming, but it's irritating.
Okay. Rec, I'm going to give you a moment to get that under control. I'm going to unmute you in a second because I want to hear your story. I want to say hello to Hatter. Hey, Hatter.
Hey, how are you?
How's it going? I'm gonna give Rack a moment to settle himself. What do you think about 8 foot scorpions?
Oh man, frightening. Like the, you know, it's like a 3 foot dragonfly.
Yeah, I did the giant dragonflies 1 month. I can't remember what month I did it in, but a little while ago. I couldn't even imagine it. That's just insane. And they're 8 feet, but that's not even including their little creepy legs. like 8 feet, but think about how big their legs are, like crawling up everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And their claws.
Or a praying mantis. All
right, hold on. Let me.
Or a praying mantis. A praying mantis would be a killer.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I'll have to see if there's anything like that. Let me check in on Rec.
Okay.
Are you all set? Are you all set, Rack?
Oh, it'll probably start again because it doesn't want to shut turn off. But yeah.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that came to mind, you know, if you were in like a battle, you know, the whole idea of a tank, and they mentioned the scorpion like a tank. You know, it's got the armor, it's got the weaponry, it's got the mobility. It's one of those things that, you know, like you say, they're fearsome. You know, it's the apex predator slash design element of it. You know, it's nature showing off. And, you know, the survivability of something like that, when they develop the claws to grab and that tail, oh, my goodness. The bit of trivia I found out about scorpions that I love is that they glow in under black light. They glow. They fluoresce. So, you know, if you ever want to know if there's a scorpion in the room, look with a black light.
Wow. Oh, I'm so glad I don't live in one of those states. I have to tell you, it'll be hard to move me out of New Hampshire. I think the furthest I might go is maybe Vermont, and that's about it. I don't have to worry about that here, I don't think.
Because they like the dark places and stuff. That's why, you know, people that you leave your boots on the side of the bed. If you're in like Arizona, you got to shake your boots out and make sure there's no scorpions in them before you put them on.
Yes, I know someone that does that to this day. I helped someone out, and she's an older woman, and every time she gets dressed, she shakes out her boots, and because she's from Texas,
yeah.
Right? So. So what I thought was really cool, and Hatter, this is like a free, you speak when you want to. You don't have to wait for me to call on you. Just, you know, obviously don't speak over anybody, but jump in anytime you want. But I learned lots of things, but what I found out is that at the Yale Peabody Museum acquired the largest and most diverse collection of of the fossils ever assembled. And in places like New York, collected almost 50 years, and Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio, and in Ontario, in Canada. But, like, the Peabody Museum isn't only in Connecticut. I mean, that's not really far from me. I could go see them. I think that's pretty cool, and I think that I might put that on my to-do list to go look at these giant sea scorpion fossils. I think that would be a fun day. Yeah. I mean, Connecticut's not that far. Yeah. So I did say a disclaimer at the beginning, Hatter. I'm getting over a cold. My voice isn't what it should be. So please be patient with me for that. But would you go to a museum, Hatter, and visit some giant sea scorpion fossils?
Would I? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Have you ever, either one of you, have you guys ever been to a museum with fossils besides, like, I mean, even if you went to a dinosaur, like, have you ever been to a museum with fossils before?
Yeah, I think the State Fair usually has some kind of exhibit, but I actually went down with some buddies to the Santa Cruz Mountains and climbed up on this hill and where these fossils are supposed to be for the ocean creatures. And I found a megalodon tooth about 5 inches wide, about 4.5 inches long, perfect shape.
Oh, my gosh.
You just found it?
Yeah, I found it inside of the we were looking for little teeth, a little shark teeth, and I saw the tip of this thing and pulled it out, and it was this huge megalodon thing. Yeah, perfect.
And what did you do with it?
I kept it. It was eventually stolen by some idiots. But,
oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness. What a find, huh? Well,
yeah.
I've been down to the Museum of Science. I don't know if they have any. I haven't been there in so long. I don't actually know if even they had fossils there. I'm sure they did, maybe. I can't remember because it's been so long. I mean, I guess I could Google it, but I just don't remember. But I don't think I've ever been to, like, a museum to go specifically to see a certain fossil exhibit. I think I might take a trip to Connecticut. I think I want to see. I think I want to see giant sea scorpions.
Yeah, go on
did you happen to... Yeah. Well, it surprises me that things, I mean, with the... It surprises me that things are still being found today, because I feel like mankind have pretty much turned the world over, right?
You would think so. But
you would think
they only
so, yeah.
look for things that they know they're looking for.
Yeah.
That's
it could be right next to you, and you don't know until you start digging.
Yeah, for some kids.
Well, what they should do is just go in the ocean, right, and start digging there. They'll find a lot of new things, I think. Get some better technology to withstand the pressure. You know, work on as much as we work on going out in space, work on getting us down under. I feel like we would have a lot of stuff. I saw this article that they found a 400-year-old female shark recently.
Oh, wow.
Alive?
Yeah. Like it was the oldest living creature right now. I didn't really read the article very well. Yeah, it was
Greenland.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
It was Greenland.
No,
yeah.
I just know the Greenland shark is one of the oldest. It's the longest.
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was a Greenland shark. I didn't read the whole article because I wasn't looking to read at that moment. And I just happened upon it. And I was like, oh, interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think they have five gills.
Oh, really?
I think they have an extra gill, Greenland shark. Mm. Yeah, they're pretty big.
I've never seen a shark. Well, I have. I've seen that shark in a tank, but that's about it. I'm going to drop. Oh, I didn't even keep your link, Rack. Oh my gosh.
That's because my link is salt, not the ocean.
Well, the ocean. Oh, you mean for the Mediterranean salt one? Hmm. Oh, okay. Well, do you mind if I play it now? Just
no,
so
not
that
at
I
all.
Make sure someone else is here. So,
yeah.
One of the other prompts were giant rocks of salt in the Mediterranean, and we'll get back to that after. But I'm going to drop Rex now. So his is tears, salt. It's all related. We're going down the tube. We're fine. and Hatter, if you have anything related to any of the topics, you can put it up. It doesn't have to specifically be about the information, just inspired by. And then, of course, I promote and love conversation about the topic itself. So, and your thoughts on it. Did you see any of the videos, Hatter, or we starting fresh while I'm playing them tonight?
I'm saying, say that again.
Did you see the videos?
Did you see the videos, or are you starting fresh when I play them tonight? I'm going to play them, so you still have an opportunity.
I'm starting fresh, yeah.
Good, yeah.
Yeah,
well, it's fine. You have a lot of random information.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, don't worry about it. Yeah. They're good short informational. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to press play for Rack, and...
Okay.
Tears. And then, of course, you're welcome to drop a poem on the board, Hatter. Let's see.
Okay.
Tears by Raconteur. The tears I cry fall from eyes that one time had forgotten, had a weep, had a sigh from love misbegotten, freely flowing, remembering pain, feeling once again, easily now, like dew they fall, after morning's rain. My heart is hurt this final time, an ending to a game. It's over now, I've lost again, a player, nevermore. But the bittersweet memory, how to cry, reopens a rusted door. End poem.
Excellent. And of course, this is probably it is from the Hurt Locker. My love-hate relationship with this folder. I love the words, and I love the language, and I love how it pulls such wonderful, it wonderfully pulls emotion from the reader, but it's also very sad to think about, and it's that's truth as well. I loved how you started with the how to weep, how to sigh from love. Like, how do you do this? It's almost that you have to relearn those types of things, even though you've gone through them before. And I think the reason why that is because, like, everyone is different. You know, every experience is changed a bit, so you don't always weep the same or sigh the same because they're all different loves. And I like that you're talking about having to relearn. And then I like down here at the bottom how you say a player, nevermore. And I like that because I know you don't mean it in the intent of, oh, I'm a player. You mean it in the intent, a player of the game of love. And I liked that turn. I liked that turn of phrase because I think that word, that language gets used in the other connotations so much more, like, oh, I'm a player, I play the field and do all these things. So to change it around and give a different spin on it, a different tune to it, the player in the game of love, and, you know, I've lost again and it's over, and I'm just left with these bittersweet memories. I really liked that sentiment. I liked that twist. I wasn't quite expecting it. And I liked the idea of the rusted door. Like, you obviously when things are they can erode and with salt and rust and time and clothes, and now you're going to have to travel through it again. So there was lots of different metaphors there in that one line, and I appreciated that as well. I read this one before, but I always love rereading and revisiting poetry. So thank you for bringing this one. And Hatter, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a realization of if it's over, it's gone. Don't have the fight anymore. I remember that. You have to have the desire to jump back in, I guess, huh?
Kind of like one of the stages of grief, you know. You got to move that and mourn the loss.
Yeah, and I don't know, which one would this be? Which stage would this be?
I couldn't even name the five stages of grief. One of them is anger, though. So.
I could really relate to it, though. Very good.
That was my hope.
Thank you, Hatter. Excellent comment. And five stages of grief, denial, anger. Oh, my gosh. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally accepting.
Thank you.
So, and maybe this would fall into the fourth.
A little bit of depression, maybe.
Well, you can find any poem about salt or the sea or about frogs, Hatter. You can. You should have heard. What were some of the ways that you were spinning? You should have heard Rack trying to spin ways that we could. People can bring poems. Do you want to say a couple?
You have a poem about pants. Pants have zippers. Zippers are called flies. Frogs eat flies.
There you go.
He's very creative. He's like frogs. You kiss the frog. He turns into a prince. Do you have a poem about a prince? Like, he was really on a roll before the show, trying to twist it and seeing how many different ways people can bring poems that they don't necessarily have to write about the subject. Which I never, you know, if people write about the subject, that's cool, that's great. If they don't, that's okay too. I honestly like the conversation. And I like to learn little new things that are really quirky and weird. Like, remember how we did that one about the mushrooms, the giant mushrooms that actually brought about the trees? The giant mushrooms were here before the trees and it created the trees. And I had just gotten into a conversation with a fellow teacher, and they were talking about how one of their students, when I'm like, yeah, and I had said it, and they were like, oh, this student just said it too. And then I was like, oh, me and that student should hang out. Like, it was funny. But it comes up in conversation. It's cool little things and you can talk about and learn about and kind of understand about our world a little bit better. I think I have a fixation for the Devonian period. I've done a lot of Devonian period things. I don't know if you've all noticed.
The Edwardian? Did you say Edwardian?
Devonian.
The Devonian period. I think it's the giant stuff. I mean, we did the giant snakes, right? We did the giant firefly.
It was an interesting time.
Yeah, and I just I don't know. And then of course I'm always in the ocean. I'm trying to get a few things out in outer space, but I tend to like the ocean. All right, well, thank you, Rack, for bringing the poem. And do you have anything that's coming up that you want to talk about?
No, the last Tuesday of the month, I'm going to do my off the rack, but I don't have a subject yet.
All right, that's in 2 weeks on the 27th, off the rack, subject to be announced, usually starting about 10 or 11 on a team of voices. And, yeah, that'll be fun. Did you ever do your makeup show?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah, I called. I called in late. That's right, because I was at a painting class, and I called in late. All right, and while we're on the subject of plugging shows, you might as well... Do you have a show coming up, Hatter?
Well, the only one I got is Saturday with
Saturday.
Taylor and Deborah Lee, and it's the prompt is palette, like a painting palette.
What, you can't say a palette like in your mouth?
Well, that was
or
a
like
piece
food?
Pick.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Anything's fair. Yeah.
I think I have a lot of poems with palette in it. I tend to write a lot of painting metaphors because I like to paint maybe.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Saturday. What am I doing Saturday? Oh, I'm getting in the car. I think I'll be around. So that's a cool subject. Thank you, Hatter. I'm going to plug for Sweet and for Liquid Damage, but I'm not going to plug for Deb because I know she's going to call in. I'll let her do it herself. But on Thursday night, Sweet Discussions, Into the Fire, on a team of voices, she'll be going on. And the prompt is Fire, the Creator and the Destructor. I would like to discuss the element Fire. She goes on to say, my greatest fear and admiration goes to the element of fire. With its swift, brutal judgment, it will destroy anything in its path. I definitely have some fire poems, too. That's a cool subject. And then, of course, Friday on the 16th, starting at 10. I'm really liking these 10 o'clock because, you know, I don't like to stay up too late. Liquid Damage is doing open poetry, so that's going to be fun. I dropped for her last Friday, and I had to not go because I was a lot worse than I am now, and I ended up having to pull the poem because I was not about to call. But I look forward to visiting you this Friday. And then, of course, I am on a Poetic Slice on Thursday. Actually, let me back up a little bit. I know that Stephen and Kay aren't here, but Stephen always usually calls, and Kay always supports and announces the shows on a team of voices. So I think we should also say thank you and plug tomorrow, Poetic Inklings, at 7:30. She's featuring her Artist of the Year, which is Agnes Cecil. Fabulous paintings. Go check them out. You could write to them. I already have mine picked out. They're really great. So go check them out. And they're on at 7:30 tomorrow. And then I'm doing a lot of talking at once. It's starting to hurt my voice. I am doing Star Wars Volume 21, Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. You could write to any of the themes, characters, and or quotes. Quotes can go anywhere you want, even if off-topic from the topic itself. Some of the character spotlights are Yoda, Darth Vader, Boba Fett, and then there's some more. So you can go check those. General Akbar, partially. You could also write about the Sarlacc or the Rancor. I didn't just put, I put some other creature highlights, so you can go where you want. But, yeah. All right, so Hatter, what does your poem, which prompt does it go to? So I can put
it. Oh, I don't know. I threw a dart.
You threw
a dart.
It is really... It is really random stuff, so we'll go with it. You could actually read. Are you hanging out for a little bit? Yeah, why don't you read now before we play another video? Why don't we read you now?
Okay. Are we doing the video, or you want me to read?
Oh, no. Read. If I do the video, then we're going to talk about the video, and it'll be like a while. So you can read first. Yeah.
Okay. All right. The dart hit, washing the face of the moon. Let's say this. I know a guy who gets too high washing the face of the moon. He swears he does it because he loves it, claiming it's his balloon. Carrying the pain, he creates the shame, staining his eyes to blue. Choosing to try, pretends not to cry while washing the face of the moon. I know a guy that turns the wheels that lowers the sun to the sea. I watched him near in time to hear. They say he looks just like me. I know the guy who tries to fly knowing that he has no wings. Calmly says it's in his head. It's always been my dream. So I am the one that writes in tongues, changing names to what surrounds me. Knowing it all, it's off in the fall, to realize it just can't be.
Excellent poem. And this does relate, because I did just say I would probably benefit from having more space-type prompts. So we talked about it. Totally in-game. Yeah, I read this one before, and I actually remembered it. And I have to be honest with you, I don't always remember everything that I read in the past right on site, but as soon as I pulled this up, I did remember it. I love the way that you did it, the way that you had said, I know a guy, and then it gets too high, washing the face on the moon. And of course, it makes me think of when your hopes are too high, when you aim too high, when you believe and you have that that ability to fall because you've set your sights at a higher, you know, everybody's always saying, you know, dream big. But when you do, you're vulnerable to losing that as well, and that can be a scary thing. So I love how you first set us up with this guy, and then it's like a third person at this point, you know, carrying the pain, creates the shame, staining his eyes to blue with the tears, so I like that metaphor, and choosing to try. I like that because it is a choice to put yourself out there and to try new things, to strive for new things. It's a conscious act. It doesn't just happen. So I just like that line as well. And then I like the turn where you know, they say he looks just like me, and then the reader at that point understands that this poem is self-reflecting, but processing through a third person. So I really like the way that you set it up. Instead of just saying that throughout the whole piece, I like the way that you set that up, and then probably three quarters down, you throw that line out, and uh-huh. You still return to I know the guy. I really enjoyed that, actually. That was one of my favorite attributes about the poem. And then, of course, you bring in the writing, and then he writes in puns. And I think sometimes people can be witty to hide pain. And so I liked that line. I thought it was very weighty, even though it was just like a throw out there line. But it can be very weighty because a lot of times the funniest person in the room is often the loneliest. So I liked the way that you put that. Really well done. I enjoyed reading this again. Listening to you read it. And Raconteur, what are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed this very much. I'm going to claim for all of New York, you know, that expression, I know a guy, you know, I love that. That makes it so relatable for me. You know, I grew up, you know, somebody knows somebody, you know. Hey, you got a problem with your pool? I know a guy, you know. I can help you out. Don't worry about it. You know, it had that attitude that made it very, very relatable for me, the environment I grew up in and everything. And then, you know, you do that throughout the rest of the poem, too, like Sky mentioned. You know, when you say, you know, some say he looks like me, you know, you kind of flip it on its head and you know, now it's not, you know, observation, it's reflection. So, you know, it's really a lovely device to use, and you wield it very, very wonderfully throughout the whole piece. You know, it's not just the way that you bob through it that makes it memorable, but it's the relatability to how you come up with the situations that you're describing. You know, and anyone could, you know, come upon something or something like that, but the way you do it, it just fits into the flow of the story and sets a mood and a tone that's just very somber or, you know, emotional, you know, and you draw out the emotions very well.
Yeah, you know, too many guys not to have it mean talking about himself, huh?
The expression that comes to mind is when you point one finger at someone else, three point back at you.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Hatter. I don't think Deb was here, but I'm going to ask her anyway. Hi, Deb. How are you?
I'm hanging in. How are you?
Good. Did you hop in here? Yeah, there's no singing tonight, Rack. I'm lucky I'm even here with this voice. No singing. Did you happen to hear? I don't
she's
think
she's got a frog in her throat.
I do have a frog in my throat. Did you happen to hear Hatter's poem?
I didn't get to hear it, but while you guys were commenting, I took a peek and I actually remember it. I got here right before Rack commented, and hey, I know a guy too. Just saying. but why you really do sound like you don't feel good, huh?
Yeah, it was I actually found a lot better. I was pretty sick. That's why I pulled out of the show on Friday for liquid damage. I was really sick over the weekend. I actually didn't even go into work on Sunday, and I slept till 5. But I'm recovering. I feel a lot better, and believe it or not, I sound a lot better. But my voice is on the mend. It's on the mend.
Well, I'm glad for that.
Did you want to make a comment for Hatter?
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually wrote in my comment, trademark brilliance, Hatter. Nobody can deny that this is your signature style. We call it that Hatter rhyme. But right from the get-go, I know a guy who gets too high washing the face of the moon. He swears he does it because he loves it, claiming it's his balloon. I love the idea of it being his balloon. I think that it came out really cool. And sorry about that. It sounds like it's in my voice. I also, of course, got to point out, I know a guy that turns the wheels that lowers the sun to the sea. I think that's a cool concept as well, that he turns the wheels that lowers the sun as if it was pushed up on like an assembly line or something to hang it or maybe like gears in a clock. Some cool concepts in there, Hatter.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I've mentioned before, how many times have you, in how many different ways has somebody described the sunset? You know, the dying sun, you know, chasing the, being chased by the moon or something. So that was my...
Yeah, I don't think you were the first. The wheel
I think
that
is my favorite. Yeah. Because it seems very steampunkish, you know. I could see the steampunk wheels or gears. Yeah.
Gears and wheels. Yeah, absolutely. I can see the steampunk.
That would be a cool picture. Yeah, that would be a cool picture to see. Hatter, you're on a mission, okay? I would like a picture of a guy in with, you know, doing the wheel to lower down a sun. One of your little black and white sketches. You're on a mission now.
Okay.
You to work.
All right. I'll see if I can do that.
I think that would be
right
cool. Yeah.
Okay.
And I bet you can even write a whole poem just about that, because I mean it is a brilliant idea. Like, and just write a whole poem about that subject and then put that picture to it. I think that would be a really cool poem. I really do. I think that's a really great idea. Thank
you,
Deb, for your
expert comment. Okay.
I've seen him do the wheels and gears and stuff. He draws them really cool, so I know he can do it.
Yeah, I've seen that too, and that's why I know he can do it too. So I think it's a really cool, it would be a cool little sketch, and to expound upon that one line would be, a fantastic. But thank you, Deb, and thank you, Hatter. I am going to hold off on the frog video from PBS, and I'm going to do it after Deb reads. Plus, usually her poems are packed with information anyway, so she's probably going to give us a rundown. Can I ask you why you picked the frog?
I don't know. I watched the videos, and I actually found it really fascinating that the old version of the giant frog and the newer giant frogs are so far apart, and the continent split so long ago that I thought it was really fascinating how how they try to tie them together, but they can't see a way where, you know, they would have been like ancestors, unless, of course, they found one of those floating piles of debris or some type of raft-ish thing to float all the way. But I thought that it was just really cool. Plus, as soon as I saw it, as all these different things started going through my mind, Jeremiah was a bullfrog and Kermit the Frog, and actually I went a totally unexpected way with the prompt this time.
Awesome. Okay, well, you have the mic. If you have anything else you want to talk about, you're free to do it now or after your poem, or just read your poem, whatever you want. Your call.
All right, well, I think I'll dive in. Another thing I found really fascinating was the different names they called them, you know, the Pac-Man frog and the Goliath and the this and the that. I mean, who knew there were so many pet names for giant frogs, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, this is called, Is Bill the Bufo the Pac-Man Frog's Cousin? And here we go. Jeremiah is the bullfrog from the Three Dog Night song, and Toadzilla is the warded cane frog from the South. That giant cane frog weighs in at over 5 pounds from munching on live mice in his big mouth. Canes dwell in the Australian rainforest, too. Bones, nicknamed the giant fossil frog from hell. The amphibians are hunted in their tropical habitats for the legs and for the meat that the frog hunters sell. People dine on frog legs dipped in batter and then fried. They eat them served in risotto and in crux of stew. Folks say the frog's meat tastes like eating chicken, but I cannot make myself eat Kermit. Do you?
Excellent. Am I on mute? I don't remember. No, I'm not. Okay. I wouldn't eat Kermit. I wouldn't do it. Oh, we need to take a poll. Who will eat frog legs? I will take it after I comment. After everybody comments, rather. Or I'll say it when I call on them. This is so cool. And, you know, I should have thought, I should have opened with Jeremiah with the Bullfrog for the opening song. At first, when I was looking for music tonight, I was thinking, well, is there a song about giants? But I didn't even think about Jeremiah. So now I got it in, I got it stuck in my head. But that was so fun how you twisted it. It always amazes me how you can, you know, on these shows, I tell people you can write factual, you can just write but it, anything that's basically inspired. And I am happy with either one. I do have to say it amazes me how you can write factual poems and it doesn't sound like I don't find factual things boring, but a lot of people might find like text knowledge things boring. If it's just facts after fact after fact, I don't mind that, but I know a lot of people do. And I like how your poem, it's not stagnant. It's like still poetry, but yet so full of facts. And it always impresses me that you can dance on that line. You can dance on that line of creativity and fact. And not a lot of, the people that can teach facts in a fun way, I admire so much because you're going to remember it more. And people that can teach things through poetry, because I mean, poetry is my favorite venue of expression, besides song, which is basically just poetry, with lyrics. But to do that and teach about these crazy things like Pac-Man frogs, which by the way, I love that you titled it that, because that was my favorite one. That was my favorite little pet name that they had, because I love Pac-Man. It's just, if I were to write a poem about my show, I probably would have gone on this whole Pac-Man like fandom, not really factual. I just would have been on this whole Pac-Man, you know, binge here. But I also love how you talk about the bones nicknamed after Giles Fossil. Look at those alliteration F's. Oh, my goodness. Bones nicknamed, I can't even say it, the giant fossil frog from hell. Their simians are hunted in their tropical habits for their legs and their meat in the frog hunter's cell. I think it is an interesting concept. I know in other countries they have different sources of food. So, I mean, I would have to look at the population to see if I'm angry about that or not. I'm not sure if I'm angry yet. I would have to look at the population. But I know in other – I'm sorry, do you have information on that?
No. I'm laughing.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I don't know if I'm angry yet. But if they're not endangered, I'm okay. Like, I mean, because people can get meat from various sources, I guess. But I don't think that I would ever eat frog legs. I'm not that adventurous, I guess. So you bring that in, and you put this like that. Like I just like even looking at the fried frog legs. I don't think I would be able to do it. But more power to people that do that. I like how you related it to Kermit. This went into so many different directions, and yet they all fit together, and it's just kind of crazy. I mean, you can like serve them. With, Yeah, it's Rack. He's on the fritz today. Every once in a while, he gets a little out of hand. I better mute him. When he usually gets it together. You go to risotto crop stew to Kermit the Frog. I mean, this is just so fun. And I'm going to cut myself off soon. And I also like how you ended it in a question. Like, I can't make myself eat Kermit. Do you? I think that's funny. And then this meme, this picture, not meme, but this picture of Kermit the Frog is just too much. Absolutely brilliant. Really well done. I appreciate the poem, the facts, the fact that you...
Look at the photo above Kermit, Sky. Kermit is in the same pose as the top pair of legs. So I had to work there. I just had to do it. You. I say, they say it tastes like chicken. Then have some damn chicken, because, like, leave Kermit alone. But then, you know, a lot of people like chocolate-covered crickets, and you can keep them, too, and I love chocolate.
Yeah, I don't know about that either. I mean, I think they're supposed to have a lot of protein, but, yeah, no.
Yeah. Peanut butter.
I'm not going to do that. This is so fun. Thank you. And thanks for watching the video and learning some stuff. And by the way, you're close to Connecticut, kinda. If you do want to see, I know you didn't write about giant scorpions, but if you want to see the fossils of giant scorpions, they're right in the Yale Peabody Museum, and you can go check them out. Just FYI. We'll make a day trip.
Very cool.
Let me see if Brack is off the fritz.
Yeah,
it interrupted a good part of a poem, but
he frog here.
Yeah, I muted everyone when she started reading. So, I would like to know, would you eat frog legs?
I would just say that I tried them and you know, address that hype about, you know, it tastes like chicken. It's like that.
Okay.
That's such a cop out, you know. That's a generic statement. I think it's like, you know, that's not the identifier. You know, it's I won't say flavorless, but you know, chicken's got a distinct, you know, thing to it. So, you know, to say that it tastes like chicken, it's like, well, you know, there's got to be a different way to make it that it doesn't taste like chicken, you know, anyways. It's just a weird thing. But yeah, I would want to try it.
Okay. One for in favor.
Well,
and what did you think about...
taste like chicken, too, and I don't want to taste them either. Just say.
Everything tastes like chicken. My mom used to call everything chicken. She'd cook steak. Oh, no, that wasn't my mom. That was me. I just said everything was chicken. I'm not blaming my mom, but I'm pretty sure it was me. My best friend was like, what are we eating? I'm like, it's chicken. She's like, this is pork. I'm like, yeah, it's chicken, whatever. I used to do that when I was younger, I guess. But what did you think about that poem?
Oh, you say hi?
You heard my phone screaming. I had a problem. Half her poem. I'm sorry.
You were having. I see. I remember. Now I know why you said that. Well, it was great. Just to let you know. I understand now. Your phone had a problem.
I mean, you know, she made
Kermit
the Frog references. Yeah. It had to be cool.
Yeah.
Well, I even added, it's not easy being green at the bottom, just saying.
There you go. That's perfect.
I bet Rack can say that. Your Kermit got cut off at the beginning, Rack, so you can say it's not easy being green if you really want to before I go to Hatter.
Now, well, in his voice, pretty much the only thing I say is, hey, Paul, come at the frog here.
There you go. Rack, if you don't know this, or if nobody knows this that's listening, Rack does amazing voiceovers, actually. They're pretty funny. Hatter, so question of the night that Deb brought, would you eat frog legs, yes or no? And then if you could please comment as well on her poem. Oh,
I could eat frog legs. I choose not to.
Okay.
Does this suggest that you could eat cane toads, frog legs? I don't think you can.
Yeah, I don't know. Rack is all by himself in this venture. You're gonna have to go have frog legs by yourself, Rack. All right. So what do you think about Deb's poem, Hatter?
Yeah, it is a problem down in Australia, the cane toad. I think it would be it wouldn't be a problem if you could eat the legs. Then there would be a market for them. But I don't think you can. They are ugly.
Actually, I think that you're right, Hatter. The meat, I believe, is poisonous. But by the time I got to the frog legs, I was sort of leaning towards trying to joke around about Kermit. or Jeremiah. Yeah, you can't eat all frogs because some of them are hazardous. But I don't care. I don't eat Kermit, whether he's poisonous or not.
Have you tried gator or ostrich or anything?
No gator.
I guess I'm too basic as far as food.
No, I haven't either.
Like,
I don't eat.
Hatter, what do you think about Depp's poem?
I like it. I like
you
it.
Like
it hits
it.
On the problem with the cane toad. Toadzilla made me laugh. And Toadzilla is the warded cane frog from the south. All mouth.
Excellent. Thanks.
Thank you, Hatter.
Thank you, Hatter. Deb, I plugged Sweet and Liquid Damage. Rack plugged his show. Hatter plugged his show. But I wanted you to be able to plug your own show. And I got to tell you, I wrote a poem for your show. So I am now, because you rescheduled, I am ahead. I'm a good doobie, and I wrote ahead of time, not on time. So thanks for letting me be ahead for once.
I'm not sure when that one will play out, because that one's the one that had to be postponed is on my quotes, but AP was hosting it. He was making me do this show, so we will have to wait until he's out of the hospital, and then we'll work it into the schedule. So with that being said, on the 19th, because like they're lined up, and there's another poet in the wings, which is Jenny the Deep, and I have bunch of quotes from her poetry, and I have a new artist that I stumbled on. His name is Gary Gay, and he had some really pretty art, some fun art, kitties and puppies and flowers and some beautiful scenery and stuff that I matched up with the quotes I chose for her. So that'll be Monday at 10. And I assume that Saturday is up in the air at the moment as well, because that is Palette, AP's topic. So if he's not out, we'll see. We'll play that by ear. We have a couple of days to see what's what. I'm pretty sure he won't be out by then, though.
Okay, well, I hope it's okay. Lots of support to you. If you ever need me to help you host on a Monday for that show, push it to 9, and I'd be happy to host for you. 9 to 11, though. That's 12 o'clock. It's too late for my blood. Just keep that in mind. If AP ends up not being able to do it, please keep me in your mind. And thanks for calling. I'm going to play the frog video next, but thanks, Sam.
No problem. And usually it's Hatter and I. This one just happens to be AP was – I was trying to skate by without anybody noticing that I didn't do one on my own quotes, but it didn't quite work out that way. And he really wanted to post that particular show. So
– Oh, okay. Yeah.
There was a number of us that post AP told him to do it.
Yeah.
I have a question. Did I ever read you the? I know you commented on it, so I must have. Did I ever read you AP's poem about the moon? Did I call on a Saturday to read that to him? I can't remember. Did you just comment on it, or did I ever read that to you live?
I don't know.
We don't read.
Yeah, we don't read for you if you're not there. But I probably commented on it anyway. But I'm not terribly sure, Sky. I just know that.
Yeah, I don't think I ever read it for you. I'll bring it to a show, a random show, a Monday show, because I've been trying to be good and write new stuff for your Monday. But maybe on an open I want to bring it to a team of voices first before I read it anywhere else. But I don't have I don't have it planned to be read anywhere else. But maybe on Friday, on open poetry, I'll bring that one because I don't think I ever read it.
Well, either that or bring it to any Saturday you want and just, you know, remind us that it, well, I'll know, but just remind us that it's a Saturday show that you missed. Just put it on
yeah.
your IOU.
It was a Monday.
Like
it,
oh, it was a
it
Monday.
Was Monday. It was AP's quotes.
Oh, it was AP's quotes on my Monday. Okay, well, yeah, that either
yeah.
way is fine, Saturday or a Monday. Or
and
a
then
Monday.
I wasn't able to call. Yeah, and then I don't think I ever read it, so I'm going to have to get that together. I don't think I ever read it on live for you yet, so I'll do
well,
that.
Well, I look forward to it then.
All right. Okay, well, have a great night. And
you too. Feel better. And, love and respect, everyone.
Okay, you too. All right. I am going to play the frog video. And we can learn about frogs, and then we could talk a little bit about frogs more. I mean, I think pretty much Deb really covered the frogs, but you guys can put your input in as well after the frog video. So enjoy.
It's 70 million years ago, and you are in northwestern Madagascar. The climate is subtropical and very seasonal, with long periods of drought broken up by stretches of heavy rain. Rivers dry up, leaving only ephemeral pools behind. It's a hard place to live, for you and even your average amphibian. But this place is home to one hell of a weird frog. Paleontologists call it Beelzebufo, the so-called devil frog. And it may have been the largest frog that ever lived. Beelzebufo thrived in this environment, possibly because of adaptations that it had in common with some modern frogs that still live in these kinds of habitats. For one thing, its proportions were just weird, because it had a disproportionately big head and a really wide mouth. And it probably had an incredibly powerful bite, making it a serious predator for smaller animals. It also had these flanges of bone on the back corners of its skull that were so big that they may have overlapped with its shoulder blades and even affected the movement of its arms. Now, the thing is, there are frogs around today that look a lot like this, with big bumpy skulls and huge mouths. And do you want to know what they're called? Because it's really awesome. When scientists are trying to be all serious about them, they refer to these modern frogs as ceratophryids. But they're more commonly known as, wait for it, Pac-Man frogs. And phylogenetic studies group Beelzebufo with modern Pac-Man frogs. But here's the problem. Pac-Man frogs only live in South America, and Beelzebufo is only known from Madagascar around 70 million years ago. And Madagascar and South America haven't been connected for like 115 million years. So if these frogs are related, paleontologists have to explain how they ended up in totally separate places and figure out where and when their ancestors lived. And if it turns out that they aren't related, then why do they look so similar? Untangling the origins of Beelzebufo, the giant frog that lived alongside the dinosaurs, turns out to be one of the most bedeviling problems in the history of amphibians. The first fossils of Beelzebufo were collected in 1993 in the Madjunga Basin of Madagascar, and more bits and pieces were found each field season after that. But this odd frog wasn't fully described until 2008, once there was enough of it to compare to other living and extinct frogs. And that comparison to living frogs is where the trouble started. Even before the discovery of a partial cranium in 2010, it was clear that Beelzebufo really looked like a Pac-Man frog that had somehow ended up on the wrong continent. And the devil frog also turned out to be just really big. The biggest modern frogs live in Africa and are known as Goliath frogs. These chunky boys can get up to just over 30 centimeters long and weigh more than 3 kilograms. But the largest estimates put Beelzebufo around 40 centimeters long and 4.5 kilograms. And based on its features, we can get at least some insights into what its ancient habitat was like, and maybe even its behavior. For example, based on its limb proportions, the devil frog probably walked on land rather than hopping from tree to tree like some frogs do. And its big blobby shape and short limbs would have helped keep it from drying out as quickly as a smaller frog would have. It also may have been a burrower, using its back legs to dig into the soil and make a nice cool place to hang out during the hottest and driest parts of the year. This is something that frogs and toads still do if they live in seasonal environments. But where things start to get weird is its head. Beelzebufo had what's called a hyperossified cranium, meaning that it had extra bone tissue that formed a series of pits and ridges over most of its skull, giving it a bumpy texture. It also had an extremely wide mouth and was probably capable of biting really hard. In a study published in 2017, researchers measured the bite forces of living Pac-Man frogs, then scaled those measurements up to estimate the bite force of Beelzebufo. And they found that the devil frog may have had a bite as strong as a snapping turtle with a similar head size, and, pound for pound, could even have rivaled that of a lion or a tiger. Living frogs, with morphologies like Beelzebufo, tend to be aggressive ambush predators. So the devil frog probably was one too. Its powerful bite may even have allowed it to prey on small crocodilians or even juvenile dinosaurs. A frog that hunted baby dinosaurs? It's possible, because several dinosaur species have been found in the same formation where Beelzebufo was found. Okay, but so all of this weirdness aside, the thing that really perplexes us about this frog is where exactly it came from. The key question is, did Beelzebufo just look like a Pac-Man frog, or was it actually related to them? Pac-Man frogs live in places a lot like where Beelzebufo lived, in warm, arid habitats with pools of water that dry up seasonally. And modern Pac-Man frogs and Ms. Pac-Man frogs are also large predators with hyper-ossified skulls. Now, it's possible that this is a case of convergent evolution, where species with similar lifestyles develop similar adaptations. In this case, giant mouths and body shapes and sizes that allow them to survive dry spells. But if they are actually related, well, we have a problem. Because then we have to explain how Beelzebufo ended up only in Madagascar, while Pac-Man frogs are found only in South America. In order for the ancestors of Beelzebufo and Pac-Man frogs to have spread to both places, there would have to have been a connection between Madagascar and South America, by way of Antarctica. But we now know that Madagascar was fully separated from Antarctica by around 115 million to 112 million years ago. So this means that the group of frogs that was ancestral to Pac-Man frogs had to, first, evolve into its own distinct group, and then migrate to Madagascar before 112 million years ago, assuming they got there by land. But so far, the science says that just wasn't the case. Molecular clock studies suggest that, at the earliest, those ancestors of Pac-Man frogs didn't evolve until 88 million years ago, long after Madagascar had already broken away. Now, the fossil record may provide some evidence that this group originated earlier, but the record is still really spotty. So the timing just doesn't work for these ancestors of Pac-Man frogs to get to Madagascar by land. Okay, but what about rafting? We know other animal groups made it to the island by riding on random, naturally formed rafts of plant material. So, could the ancestors of this giant, scary frog have done the same thing? Well, even if they did get to Madagascar after it split off, by rafting, the molecular clock estimates for when Pac-Man frogs originated are still too recent. Their origin is generally estimated at sometime after 65 million years ago, which is 5 million years after Beelzebufo was already terrorizing Madagascar. So there's a lot about this frog that science can't quite explain. Yet. We're not sure where it came from, and we're not sure where it went. All of the fossils that we've found of it come from sites dated to the late Cretaceous, and there are no frogs closely related to it on Madagascar today. So it's possible that Beelzebufo went extinct during the extinction event at the end of the Cretaceous period. But we can't know for sure until we find more sites and more fossils that are more recent than that. Now, even though we don't have a lot of answers, this weird amphibian can still teach us a lot about the patterns of evolution. Like, if Beelzebufo and Pac-Man frogs aren't related, and they just converged on the same adaptations, then that tells us that there's something about being big and mean and extra bumpy that gives a frog a selective advantage in a dry, seasonal environment. And if they are actually related, then that tells us that there may be gaps in the fossil record of frogs that's used to set the molecular clock, and that frogs were probably much more widespread back then than we thought. But hey, if nothing else, you and I learned today that Pac-Man frogs are a thing, and that makes me pretty happy.
It makes me pretty happy, too. Thank you to PBS on YouTube for always providing such wonderful videos about learning. I don't think I'm going to linger too much on the frogs because Deb really covered it. Do you guys have anything you want to add about the frogs before I move on?
Just the periods that they're talking about, 88 million years and... I mean, we get screwed as a species. We're here for less than 100 years. Nothing ever really happens as far as universally or evolutionary by Lester Whitten. The same.
We also didn't have any global-wide wiping out of us either. So don't complain too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Knock on wood. Oh my gosh, I just I have a poem here by P.B. Cusson, and it was actually to the scorpions, but I wanted to get other people read. So I'm gonna drop him and then we're gonna go right into the last video. And then we have another poem by Titus after that, and we have time to chat about the last video. So this is Ire of the Mandibles by P.V. Cusson. Below temporal sea, scorpions assault tidal prawn. Knees brine, tide, tail poison, ire of mandibles snip. In ocean trenches, pods of clawed pincers spawn.
and the poem. And it was a brevity. And I thought it was so cool because he stayed on topic. And he, like, brought in the devastation, this pause of Claude Pinscher's spawn. Like, just think about that. Like, that's what I was kind of talking about at the beginning. Like, these creatures just running around the sea, 8 feet big, with these huge pinchers. That's what I'm not even thinking about their body. I'm thinking about their long arms pinching everything. So I love, and that's exactly what I said. I said it's terrifying to think about. So I love that he went in that direction and that he brought that in. I also love the Eye of the absolutely. All right. Absolutely think that it's just so cool. Like, it's fearsome. I also like how we use the temporal sea in the prawn. I just think it's so great. And in the three lines, I'm terrified. So you've succeeded in bringing in that horror of this creature, Pee-wee, and I appreciate you taking the time to write for the show. And Hatter, what do you think?
Yeah, real short for Pee-wee. Yeah, I mean, it's all there. I don't know what to say. Piece of brevity. Pause, pinches. Was that what the original prompt was with a scorpion? Or that just came along?
It was so I have three prompts. The first one you came in at the tail end that we were talking about at the beginning. It was giant sea scorpions that lived in the Devonian period. And then the second one was the frog. Yeah, and then the last one that we're going to get to is, we'll get to that, but this was the first one, yeah.
I remember now all the creatures.
Yeah, giant creatures. Well, I thought it was great. Thank you so much, Pee-wee. I'm going to get a comment. Oh, Rack dropped. So I hope it comes back. Come back, Rack. That rhymes. While he's figuring that out, I am going to... Huh?
You don't want to be stuck with me.
I love being stuck with you. Don't you worry. Of course I do. Rack usually is like my unofficial co-host on Tuesdays. He's always here at 8. You always come by around 8:39, which I so appreciate, but Rack is usually here, so I don't panic at 8 o'clock, because at 8 o'clock, if no one's here, I'm panicking. I'm like, I'm all alone!
So, I'm a come by guy.
He's usually... So he's my unofficial co-host, and honestly, I mean, I think you stick around for most Tuesdays that I do, almost the whole show, so I appreciate that too. I appreciate people dropping or just calling in and calling in and reading and running too, so it comes all together. I am going to play the last video, and I know we just listened to the video, but I want to play this one just to get it done, and we can be a little bit more free the last little bit of the show, and we can talk about the Mediterranean Sea. And I have one more poem by Titus, and I have an audio for that, so I will play that after. So here we go. Okay. Let's learn about the Mediterranean Sea. This is also a production of PBS on YouTube, so enjoy.
In 2011, paleontologists working on the Spanish island of Menorca announced the discovery of some very odd fossils. They were the bones of a rabbit, but it wasn't like any rabbit you've ever seen. For one thing, this bunny was a giant, up to 6 times heavier than your average cottontail. It also had short hind limbs compared to its forelimbs, and feet that were tipped with claws. And this rabbit almost certainly couldn't hop. It had a stiff spine and splayed toes, very different from the flexible spines and tightly packed toes of living rabbits. They named this huge bunny Neuralagus rex, the rabbit king of Menorca, and they determined that it ruled its island kingdom during the Pliocene epoch, from around 5 million to 3 million years ago. Now, we've talked before about insular gigantism, where small animals that become isolated on islands evolve into larger forms due to a lack of...
I don't think that's the right video, Hatter. But that sounds very interesting. It's not the right video.
Okay.
Giant rabbits. I think we got our topic for our next show. Giant rabbits. How horrifying is
that?
There you
go. Giant rabbits.
All right.
Giant rabbit poop.
I'm going to need a moment. Yeah, I'm going to need a moment to recover from that because I'm going to need a moment because that's not right. And let's see. Hold on.
And this is about what? What again? Which one?
Well, it is the right video.
Okay.
Let's
go from rabbit. Just went from rabbits to something else. Okay.
Yes, so I guess it was just like, it is the right video. It's not about rabbits, but I think they just did like a little freeze thing in the beginning. So we're going to play it again. We're going to listen to that first minute again. But it's not about the rabbits. Let's talk about the rabbits. But I think I'm going to look up the rabbits after. I think it was just like saying something else in the very beginning. So let's just try that again.
In 2011, paleontologists working on the Spanish island of Menorca announced the discovery of some very odd fossils. They were the bones of a rabbit, but it wasn't like any rabbit you've ever seen. For one thing, this bunny was a giant, up to 6 times heavier than your average cottontail. It also had short hind limbs compared to its forelimbs, and feet that were tipped with claws. And this rabbit almost certainly couldn't hop. It had a stiff spine and splayed toes, very different from the flexible spines and tightly packed toes of living rabbits. They named this huge bunny Neuralagus rex, the rabbit king of Menorca, and they determined that it ruled its island kingdom during the Pliocene epoch, from around 5 million to 3 million years ago. Now, we've talked before about insular gigantism, where small animals that become isolated on islands evolve into larger forms due to a lack of predators, and that seems to be what allowed Neuralagus rex to get so big. But how did the normal-sized ancestor of Neuralagus make it onto a Mediterranean island in the first place? Well, it looks like the answer to this biological mystery is actually wrapped up in an even older geological mystery. Since the 1800s, scientists have known that the layers under the floor of the Mediterranean Sea weren't just made up of the usual sediments, like mud and sand. Instead, they're full of salt crystals. Lots and lots of salt, forming mega deposits so large that they're sometimes called the Mediterranean salt giant. And salt deposits like these are typically found in places where bodies of water have dried up. So the existence of this salt giant suggests that at one point in history, the Mediterranean Sea must have evaporated. But how could a body of water as big as the Mediterranean Sea just disappear? It would take decades and more than 1,000 research studies to even start to figure out the cause or causes of one of the greatest vanishing acts in Earth's history. Today, ocean water flows into the Mediterranean Sea from the Atlantic through a narrow passage between Europe and Africa called the Strait of Gibraltar. And that's the main source of water for the sea. Some freshwater in the form of rainfall and rivers also flows into it. But that's not enough to keep the sea filled up without the water from the Atlantic, because it has very high rates of evaporation. So, to the geologists who were trying to explain the existence of the salt giant, it looked like the main water source to the Mediterranean had somehow been turned off, like turning off a faucet in a bathtub. They called this event the Messinian Salinity Crisis, or MSC. But it wasn't easy to figure out how that water source got turned off, and researchers have been arguing about it since the 1970s. How did it happen? How long did it take? In the end, they came up with 3 main hypotheses to answer these questions and to explain how the salt giant got there. First, some scientists thought there was a global cooling event at the beginning of the crisis, in the late Miocene epoch around 6 million years ago. If the whole world cooled off into an ice age, then lots of water would have been taken out of the ocean and frozen in glaciers, reducing the water flow into the Mediterranean Sea from both the Atlantic and the rivers. An event of this magnitude would have had to have been global, not local. However, this idea was proved wrong pretty quickly.
Soon after the salt giant was discovered, researchers started studying oxygen isotopes and other geochemical data from sediment and ice cores around the world. Their data showed that the rest of the Earth wasn't abnormally hot, cold, or dry during the crisis. Plus, they found that some of the salt was deposited before any changes in sea level. So there doesn't seem to be a cooling event that was big enough to turn off the flow of water. That ruled out the first hypothesis. The second idea was that tectonic events had somehow blocked the Mediterranean off from the Atlantic and cut off the water flow. Some researchers thought that shifting ocean crust slowly blocked off the waterway between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. As the water left behind in the deep basin evaporated, it became saltier and saltier, depositing layers of salt as it dried. And this explanation was almost right. Other scientists thought that it might have been a combination of shifting crust and climate change that made the Mediterranean dry up. This was the third hypothesis. According to this model, the crust under the Strait of Gibraltar rose up over time, reducing the flow of water from the Atlantic. Then, because of changes in regional climate, like periods of less rain and higher temperatures, the amount of fresh water that made it into the Mediterranean varied. So by this thinking, the MSC didn't happen all at once. Instead, water levels started to drop after the strait closed, and then fluctuated according to changes in the climate. And this hypothesis ended up being pretty much right, or at least close to it. As geologists began collecting evidence to test these hypotheses, they eventually found that the MSC was indeed caused by changes in Earth's crust, but those shifts actually happened repeatedly, not just in one fell swoop. For example, in sediments near the Nile, geologists found evidence of repeated erosional events, not just a single big erosion. This means that the water level dropped, created a new shoreline for a bit, and then dropped again a few more times. Some researchers estimate that there were 16 climate cycles just in the beginning of the MSC. And these changes also correlated pretty closely with what we know about climate cycles. During periods of decreasing sea level, the position and angle of the Earth changed with respect to the sun, so there were periods of lower solar energy and others of higher solar energy, which increased evaporation rates in the Mediterranean. At the same time, an actively folding and uplifting tectonic belt caused water input to decrease. Researchers were able to use chemical and even magnetic signatures in sediments laid down during this time to estimate how long the MSC lasted. And the data suggests that it went on for over 600,000 years, with the very driest period occurring about 5.6 million years ago. At the height of the MSC, external water sources were completely cut off, and most of the water left behind in the Mediterranean basin was evaporating. Geologists think that the water level dropped by a few hundred meters, the length of multiple American football fields. And the water that was left was super saturated, so the salt continued to precipitate out at the bottom of the sea. The longer there was salty water that could precipitate out salt, the thicker the final deposit became. And the salt giant is possibly up to 3 kilometers thick, which means that the sea was extremely salty for the hundreds of thousands of years during the MSC. And this, of course, had enormous effects on living things in and around the Mediterranean. Back then, life in the sea was dramatically different. Today, the Mediterranean Sea is home to thousands of marine species and is famous for its crystal blue water. But when the sea almost dried up completely, it became uninhabitable. Almost nothing could live there. Most of the animals and plants that lived in the Mediterranean before the MSC either migrated away or died because the water was too salty and too shallow. Some marine paleontologists think that no true marine organism was able to survive, and the evidence for that is pretty good. For one thing, the sediments that were deposited during this period weren't disturbed, which suggests that there were no burrowing creatures living there. And even now, there are hardly any deep sea animals that are unique to the Mediterranean, because all of them died during the MSC. Some shelled creatures, like gastropods, might have survived, though they weren't exactly thriving. Sediment cores show that small populations may have eked out a living in isolated pockets. But the disappearance of the sea wasn't all bad news for living things. The lower water levels were also an opportunity for some creatures to flourish. The distribution of fossils of now extinct megafauna suggests there was once a land bridge between the mainland and several Mediterranean islands like Sardinia and Corsica that has now disappeared. This allowed hippos, elephants, and other megafauna from Africa to walk and swim across the Mediterranean. And we know that it wasn't just megafauna that took advantage of the crisis to move around. This seems to be when the ancestors of our giant rabbit friend, Neurolagus, left the European mainland for Menorca. Paleontologists have found other giant fauna, like dormice and hamsters, on islands that haven't been connected to each other since the MSC, like Malta and Sicily. This wasn't the first time that animals made a long journey to lands around the sea. It was just one of several migration events during the late Miocene. The remnants of these migrations are found in the fossilized remains of the hippos and elephants that lived there. But when the water rose back up at the end of the MSC and the land bridges disappeared, the populations were isolated from each other and from northern Africa. That isolation led to small versions of large animals, or insular dwarfism, and large versions of small animals, or insular gigantism, on islands around the Mediterranean, which solves the mystery of how Neurolagus got to Menorca and why it ended up being so big. The Mediterranean Sea is back again, of course, so obviously the water returned at some point. Models of the ocean crust suggest that the Strait of Gibraltar opened up as tectonic plates shifted again and sediments eroded, lowering the barrier between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, letting water flow through the strait and into the basin. But just like the arguments about how the MSC started, there was a lot of debate about how it ended too. At first, some scientists thought that it was replenished by a giant waterfall cascading into the Mediterranean, with water pouring in so fast it filled up in only a few months. They even found sediment deposits that suggested a rapid flooding event had occurred. And while that sounds amazing, it looks like it's not true. Well, at least not the waterfall part. More recently, other geologists using seismic data discovered that the slope between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean wasn't steep enough for there to have been a waterfall. Instead, what refilled the sea was probably more like a river. The basin did fill up quickly, though. Recent estimates say it only took around 2 years to end the MSC during an event sometimes called the Zanclean Flood. But that doesn't mean this story is over. The plates of the Earth are always shifting, and if the perfect storm of plate movement and climate change repeated itself, it could conceivably happen again. Scientists are still finding more evidence of the MSC, from those fossilized mini elephants to Neurolagus, to salt crystals found on land and under the Mediterranean Sea. And while some events leave obvious marks on the planet's surface, like mountains and craters, there are others that you have to look harder to find traces of. Even though the MSC shaped life in and around the Mediterranean for hundreds of thousands of years, its fingerprints lie mostly out of sight, buried beneath the waves. But the fossils of those dwarf elephants and giant bunnies let us see its effects and help remind us of that moment in geological time when the Mediterranean Sea disappeared.
Awesome. What I like to think about those, Hatter, is how, like, how much everything has changed over time. Like, it's kind of, like, unfathomable when you really think about it. Like, let's get a time machine.
Is the land masses, you mean? Or the animals?
Anything. Anything, really. But like, just imagine the Mediterranean Sea just drying up. And then all these changes happen, and that's how the migration happened. It's just interesting to me, all the things that had to happen to be where we are now, you know?
They finally have come to learn that kind of event wasn't isolated in man's history. The flooding through land masses due to earthquakes or erosion or what, there was, and I don't remember what sea it is, but it took a whole group of species of people, like a whole nation of people were living in this bowl, and the flood, they never knew what happened to them, I guess, and they finally realized that it was a massive flood, and it seemed to me that they would be coming from, like, the Mediterranean, so it'd have to be something that was below sea level, and that if it concurs, if it winds up working with the time periods that they're talking, the Mediterranean draining, and Gibraltar being higher, so it wasn't replenished. I can surely see that happening, but yeah. That goes along with what I was saying earlier. We, as far as events, geological or astronomical. We get screwed because we're not here long enough to witness the change.
Oh,
and anytime that happens,
mean,
like the land bridges, like the land bridges and such.
I understand
anytime
what you're saying
happens,
earlier.
Yeah. The introduction of animals through the land bridges that are formed or taken away, like the Sumatran dwarf elephants that were now extinct, meaning that they were cut off on the island. Those intrusive species would immediately cause other species to go extinct just that quickly.
Mm.
So, yeah, it is interesting.
I misunderstood what you were saying before, but now I get it. It's just when you think about all this, and this is only like a little tiny piece of it, right?
Right.
This is just a little.
Well, you know what I get? They always conclude global warming or the climate change. Well, in order for this conversation or this debate to be honest, you have to realize that where they start as being normal was not. We have been our whole lives and most all of mankind's history have come out of an ice age. We're still coming out of an ice age. We're warming up. It's been that way since we left the ice age. It's the fact. So when they want to make a base, well, what was it here 10 years ago? Well, of course not, because we're coming out of an ice age. It's not, you can't have a common date to relate anything to as far as global change, because of course it is. We're coming out of an ice age. Just say that. And as long as people are on the same level, so when they start talking about global warming, then you can have an honest debate. That's why the hate is. If you don't believe the way they think climate change is, then you're an idiot, or you're a denier of climate change. And that's not the way it is. It's a stupid argument the way it's ended up. Everybody just needs to realize where we're at any given time, going away from an ice age, and if that's approaching into another one at some point, that's exactly what's going to happen, because it comes in circles, in cycles. So...
Yeah. I mean, I and that's kind of like what I was saying earlier. We're pretty lucky because we haven't had any major, I mean, really any major events like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna look up what sea that was.
Like all the volcanoes reforming the Earth, you know, like that's pretty intense.
Well,
meteors coming and destroying.
One. I guess Russia has taken the Ural River, I believe it is, and changed its course. So the Ural Sea has dried up. You have ocean vehicles or vessels in the desert because this sea has no longer existed, and that's happened in our lifetime. I think that was a man-made event, Go ahead.
Yeah, what I think is interesting is like they're like creating like things where you can to put meteors off track of the Earth. You know, like they're making things that shoot out. Like that's just crazy. It reminds me of that film Total Impact. I think they did something like that, and then there was that other one with
Bruce Willis?
Yeah. Independence Day. Independence Day or something.
Armageddon. That's interesting. You'd think that we would have, Armageddon. You'd think that we would have proper warning. But this last event over Russia was a couple of years ago, that meteor sonic boom broke all the windows, and that came directly from the sun. They didn't know it. it was here till it was on top of us. That opened the eyes of the scientific community. Watching the sky a little better because it came directly from the sun, so we didn't see it.
Oh my gosh!
And if something's gonna hit us like that, maybe it's best that we don't see it. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm gonna play "Wonderful Conversation," Hatter. Absolutely brilliant. I am gonna play Titus. I'm not quite sure he didn't know what this was to. It might just be really random, which is okay. He wrote "This is Control." So I'm pretty excited. It seems pretty cool. I love this form, so I'm pretty excited to hear it, actually. So I'm going to go ahead and press play, and we're going to go from there. So here we go.
The troll. The ungulate art handsome mount in some respect my own superstition brings me to pursue ancestry. As to crew uncertainty from onerous effects, to crew the hoi polloi, the study of one's past taught life spirits for a forensic nature. Malfeasance surge it would bring me to convey quince's quiet. Denser the truth must be hidden. And surrounded by me, with alibi that is to be hidden, draggle myself into an obscurity, a forbidden life I own primeval. A meticulous junket for a trolling, not to convey reason, to exist on this nifty occasion when tales accrue. If disbelief holds virtue, gossip cannot account for forensic God, thy crucible, what penance is it, truth or boy polloi? Tales run rampant in this search for truth. The hoi polloi have diminished proof to the realms of folklore. Hidden, if I am to reveal myself, a gringo, or at least a forensic, a yeast uncovered, it be one lascivious nature to own, to be free from doubt that these possibilities do accrue the finagle ever teach of one's weight, if fear has to convey. Unknown that is, no alibi whatsoever will convey. Beyond the confusion, ugliness becomes this hoi polloi, the mysterious tantamount. Surrounding fear will accrue. Image of the malfeas frenzy waiting lies if hidden a forgotten world that upon a time did once we own. To free is not to be. If beauty can afford to lose forensic, I'll not want, for I'm uglier than your being just forensic. If I could find a scratch, then a cloven hoof would convey the autonomy to show such proof. I had for you to own defiance of a nature, if scrutinized, to show these hoi polloi you've gathered unceremoniously, and tethers are hidden, the evil premonitions from the devil shows they accrue. A malignancy, perhaps, an elfin trait, to aspire the accrue without margin for error. Minute fragments for a forensic show, nonetheless, by what is there, a myth will convey oddity for use under the bridge if what becomes hid. The furthest forbidden must be truth, since any hoi polloi could I ask. You burden alone what you carry you own. The ungulator bolted. These forensic leads are hidden, but what I want to convey is, as trolls we, the hoi polloi, who in this mind I own the sole right to an accrue.
Absolutely brilliant. And yes, you're right. I did ask. Well, this is down the tube, so I always tell people sometimes we go really random. Just absolutely brilliant. I really love this one. So I'm a big fan of this genre. So I love that you brought it because it's just something that I really enjoy reading. And I would think that I would be worried that background was like would overpower, but I'm telling you, it didn't. It didn't for me. It was really low. And people love to put background stuff, and it's so tricky because you really have to make it so that the words overpower the background music or the sound effects, and you did that really well. Like I was like, it was just low enough where it didn't overpower or kind of take over the poem, but it made this like when I think of like, you know, a little troll just doing its little thing and being creepy, I thought it gave wonderful to the nuance. So kudos to you on that. Like I said, I love this form. I love form poetry. I used to do a show on another group, and I did a lot of form poetry prompts. I didn't get a lot of entries because not everybody has a love of form. Not many. I mean, it isn't a common thing, I think. But I love the form. I love when people are to go the extra mile and I think it puts such a wonderful cadence to it as well. Your language is always top notch, I have to say. And your storytelling was amazing. I love how you put yourself into character. And not only did you do that with the voice, which was great, but you did it with the words and the poetry and the tale. I mean, when you have, if I am to reveal myself, I mean, if I had to reveal myself, and you put that in the first-person perspective narrative, I think you just did it wonderfully. I don't even know if I can pick a favorite stanza. This is just so hard. It really is really hard to pick a favorite part. Maybe it's the I not want from Uglier Than Being Just Forensic. And then down to the second stanza after that with what you carry, you own, with the exclamation point. Yeah, this is like theatrical kind of writing, which I absolutely love. I love it. Yes, it moves. It just moves, and it creates a story and a life of its own. I really enjoyed this. I can't say enough. This was so cool, and this the audio to it. It's just what a treat. Honestly, really well done. Oh, this thing too. See, it's so hard. I'm like, this is my favorite part. This is my favorite part. But this section of a forgotten world that upon a time did once we own. To free is not to be, if beauty can afford. I just really, to lose forensic, I really love those two lines and how you spun that once upon a time idea into this kind of like just darker sense of it. Hatter, I might go on forever if you don't just cut me off here. What do you think? This is excellent. Really well done. Yeah,
it is. It's a theatrical poetry or performance, however you want to describe it. I get lost in his work. I just find myself just totally trying to think now. The hoi polloi. That's the name of the troll or the. The character that he's describing, right? The hoi polloi, is that who that is? God, tales run rampant in search for truth. The hoi polloi. Diminished proof of the realms of folklore.
I think he's, because he previously talked about myths. So I'm going to go with
the Greek mythology. And the idea of Greek mythology meaning many. So I'm going to go with that. I think he's talking about many. Beyond the confusion, ugliness becomes this hoi polloi, a term. It's a Greek term, I believe, because he's talking about myths and stuff that he's going with this, with the idea of that. I could be wrong.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to grab. Yeah, it's well written.
Yeah. So like a group of people, the masses, the rabble. You know, I think he's going with that. Words listed at the bottom. Okay. Let's see. Boy polloi, common people and masses. Oh yeah. So that's when it was that. I didn't see that. But okay. Yes. So a group of people. So.
The hoi polloi was what?
Yeah.
I didn't hear.
It was what I said it was. It was the, what did he write here? The common people, the masses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's got the whole list.
God.
He's got a whole list here of what the uncommon words are. We're off air.
Oh, I see.
Can't hear us anymore. Yeah.
Boy, look at that. He knows we're not going to get it.
He went off air.
Common people, the masses, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Titus, just class the place up, man. You really do.
I absolutely love it. I was like, I'm not sure what this went to, and he's like, you asked for random stuff. He was right. I that is the topic. But you know what, though? I saved it for last because it was going a little off, and I'm so glad he put it in, definitely. I am going to close up. Because we are out of time. Can you believe it? We're actually off air. So, Hatter?
Yeah, I'll follow you anywhere. I'll follow you anywhere.
I'll follow me anywhere. Okay. So I want to thank Dev, Rakentor, Hatter, Pee-wee, Q-son, of course, Titus for bringing poetry, sharing your voices, talking about really random stuff, and maybe learning a little bit. And wow, what a great audio. What a way to end, huh? What a way to go out with a bang. So thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed Down the Tubes. And I'm going to close out with Gypsy Fingers. They're a rock folk band founded by Victoria and Luke Outfield, son of Mike Outfield, as inventive as anything you'll hear anytime soon, says R2 Magazine. So definitely you can check out their YouTube page. And I'm going to put that on there. Thanks for my 5 minutes. I know, we got talking. So I hope you enjoy. And there we go.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Good Chelsea guy.
Awesome. Good night, Hatter. I'll see you later.
Good night. Okay.
Thank you.